This country's not going to be saved from the top, because that's where all the rot is. It's too deep. It's going to be saved from the grassroots.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's Neville Archibald here for the Crossroads. Looks like I might be on my own this morning. We've had a cancellation from Daniel. So we'll just go on as usual. I'll give you deliver a little bit of a monologue, and we'll talk about some bits and pieces. Being Remembrance Day yesterday, it's very interesting to go back over what it means. And we've had, you know, two very severe wars, the First World War and the Second World War, which were caused out of the incorrect action of the financial system, I guess. You get to the point where the only result you have then is to pursue, when you've gone through all of the negotiations with different parties trying to become dominant powers for whatever reason, usually it's financial reasons. It's a precursor to war, and it ends up happening. And during that time, we're quite capable of producing plenty of bombs, plenty of men to send over there to be killed. And we can pursue it with all the vigor of a flourishing economy. We always seem to be able to find the money to do it. And people go over there hoping that this will be the last time, but that we will solve the problem, we will fix the issues and turn back to being a better place to live in. But what it ends up with is basically just a lot of people dead, a lot of things blown up. We've spent a lot of money, been able to survive in the meantime. Everybody at home's managed to survive, and they pick up the pieces afterwards when everyone comes back. So the sacrifices made are made earnestly by the people who are brought into the war. And then after the First World War, they came back to find that there was essentially poverty at home. So it wasn't due to the war. The amount of money that was made available to pursue the war was happy to do, but as the minute we were no longer pursuing the war, they couldn't make the money available for the peacetime. So when we think about our returned soldiers and those on Remembrance Day, I think we should also think about the reasons why they happened. They're not always as clear-cut as simply one power-hungry person trying to rule the world. We usually start off with trade wars, tariffs, whatever you want to call it, and inequalities, and it then leads on later on into full-blown financial support of a real war. So that's Remembrance Day, which has just been in many of the countries around, and a lot of the Western countries celebrate that, or remember it rather than celebrate, perhaps. And many of the people who came back from the wars were happy to push hard for something to change, some sort of way to get out of this. And that's where the social credit movements arose. You returned soldiers from the First and the Second World Wars who realized the futility of what they were doing when they came home and saw the very things that they'd been fighting against occurring in their own backyards. And they got together and they formed different organizations. The League of Rights was one of those, effectively returned soldiers. And the main supporters over the years have been of that mentality. They've been, you know, we saw what was happening. We don't want it repeated here. So they made up their policy and their institution, and they've pushed for financial reality, in Douglas's terms, economic democracy, ever since. And that's what we're here to talk about today, among other things. We have an interesting deadlock in the United States, which we see, which is also some sort of an anniversary here in Australia. with the Whitlam dismissal. The UK, the USA has had a blockade of supply, which has lasted, I think it's 42 days and it's just finished, where the public service and different groups couldn't be paid because of the dispute between the Republicans and the Democrats within the Senate. This is not the first time this has happened. It happened in 95 and 96. There was a 21-day stoppage. And then in October 13, 2013, the Obama rule. And then in 2018-19, there was a 25-day shutdown, which was due to not wanting to fund the building of the Mexican wall. This time, yes, like I said, was 42 days, which was interesting that people weren't being paid and they were calling for support for food banks and all sorts of things. In Australia, that can happen too. We've had a number of times when supply has been blocked in the upper house, in the federal government. Usually it resolves itself, but when it doesn't, as is the case with the Whitlam dismissal, we had nearly 4 weeks where the Liberals refused to pass supply in Senate, which meant that the government couldn't function secure properly. So the Governor General did what he did. He stood down when they couldn't agree to be, you know, playing in the schoolyard together. They naughty little boys were put in the corner and told, well, we're going to cancel government. We're going to stand you down and we're going to go back to the people. And the people are going to then elect who they think should be running the country if you can't agree, which, you know, to me seems very reasonable. And that's the reason why we have a very good constitution and a successful constitution. So effectively put the question back to the people. We had a double dissolution and he was roundly condemned for it. Sir John Kerr, the Governor General at the time, by many of the left-leaning groups. But in the end, it was the people who made the decision of who to put in. And that's what it should be in a democracy. That's what it should be. When you think about it, who do you want to resolve these deadlocks? Someone in power that is just lusting for power? Because eventually that's what happens, isn't it? The person who has the most power will resolve the problem. And I would like to think that, as with our system, the power reverts back to us, the people. So, yes, it's something to think about. And again, that the double dissolution was the 13th of December. We had our election. And, it was groundbreaking. But these are the reasons why we have constitutions, laws, and limits to government. In other news, another thing I saw was interesting. Senator Malcolm Roberts made a comment about Hitler being a lefty. And the media have jumped on that and made all sorts of funny accusations. But again, I haven't seen too much of what went on there. I saw some of the aftermath and the political, I don't know what you would call it, chatter that's going on about it. His intention, as far as I can tell, was that both left and right wing are totalitarian governments. And the opposite of totalitarian government is anarchy. So when you look at, are we going to be voting left or right? Do we stay in the center? Are we actually in the center of something? Or are we still on the side of totalitarian government? Because the narrow line between left and right, when they are both heading towards a totalitarian form of government, whether it be left or right, is still totalitarian. Should we not be looking for less control by government? So should we not be to the anarchy side of the equation? And I'm not calling for anarchy, that's for sure. But we have to have limited government, and the government in its own way must be limited as well. They can't just keep creating laws and making decrees and putting us in little boxes continuously, because that is restriction of freedom, and it eventually leads to Hitlerism or Stalinism. And I don't see much of a difference between the two, to be honest. They may have fought against each other, but eventually, when you look at it, it just boils down to one small group of people ruling over everybody else. So it doesn't matter the label you put on them. It is still the same reality that we live in once you get there. So, yes, we see all those sorts of things which are interesting. What else has been happening in the world? The Liberals here in Australia, looks like they may dump net zero, which is not an unusual thing in itself. I think net zero should have run its race. It has in many other parts of the world. In fact, The Economist just recently put an article up, very, very disappointed that it looks like we're not going to make our 1.5 degree drop because everybody's abandoning it. I don't think there are many who haven't taken it up either. You know, China and India are still building coal-fired power stations and pursuing their economies as though it's not a problem. And it's only those of us in the West who've been silly enough to believe the propaganda, because that's what I believe basically it is. There's an awful lot of science out there on both sides to show that climate always changes. But whether it's man-induced or not is entirely questionable. And the actions that we would have to take to make any sort of an impact, if we do make any impact, would be considerably drastic and would probably lead to other forms of pollution or other forms of damage to the environment, as we are seeing with the huge creation of windmills that don't last all that long before they're decommissioned and sent back to landfill or whatever it is, because they don't, a lot of the material they use cannot be recycled properly. There's a lot of problem with the blades and the fiberglass. And although they may be good ideas in concept, we seem to be spending an awful lot of money doing it and an awful lot of destruction of environment to carry big power lines from one small area way out in the middle of nowhere where no one wants to see, because nobody in the cities want to see them in their own backyard. They'd rather stick them way out wherever, and then have to build all the infrastructure to bring it back into the areas that they power. So like most government things, the concept of centralization means that they want to centralize all of these power creations in the one area, well away from anywhere else, or well away from the voting public, who may get a little bit upset about and vote against the party that's putting them in there. And so they tend to try and build really, really big power generating devices and then try and send it out. Huge solar farms and huge wind farms. Now, the result of that, of course, is you have huge tracts of land that are then subject to the elements. And if we have damage of the windmills or a hailstorm over a solar farm, like I saw in Texas and like we've seen in places here, there's a huge amount of broken glass and all of the chemicals that leach out once that happens and has to be dealt with and put somewhere. The current ability to recycle these things is minimal. So we are creating a lot of waste, and we will continue to get storms that will do these things, because that is just the nature of the earth. So it's interesting. So the Liberals backing away from that, and it's good to see, because with both parties heading the same direction, we're going to get the same outcome. If we have an opposition, I would have thought they should be in opposition and they should be looking at other ways of doing things. But we haven't had a true opposition in a long time. Both parties seem to be going down the same path at the same level of control that they keep implementing upon us. So with that, we've seen the COP30, which is in Brazil at the moment. That's the 30 years since the introduction of the climate discussion in Brazil back in 1995, where they signed a treaty to deal with what they saw as climate change. It's been an interesting journey, because they continually tell us that the sea levels are going to rise and these islands are going to drown, and we're going to have worse storms and all of the climate catastrophe. And there's a lot of it. There's a lot of adjectives being used and thrown around every time there's a storm somewhere. But the reality is we look at them and we don't see those storms being any different to what they would have been normally. There's no increase in severity. There's no increase in sea rises. You can look around the world to all the different places where they've been taking photos for years and look for the rise in sea level. But if you go down to your local beach in Melbourne or in Sydney, the only thing that may have happened is perhaps the beach has eroded away a little bit. Perhaps the land has moved a bit as it normally would under geological formations. But the rising sea level is, you know, it's one thing to point out that we're having this incredible rise and all that sort of thing, but you actually have to see it in the real world. And we are not seeing it. And more people are waking up to that. So I like to think that people are taking notice of things that go on. Those people who live in the real world are seeing things. Hopefully they can pass it on to those who don't venture out into that real world. Those people who basically rely upon their feed from the news and enjoy a little bit of catastrophe. It's just those of us who actually go and see these sites or look around the world and see these places and think, well, nothing's changed. Or you see that there's a typhoon and they talk about how bad it's going to be. There's been typhoons in this area many years, for many years. And sometimes they're bad and sometimes they're not. There are times when I've seen people talk about the amount of destruction and they put a dollar figure on it. It's such a huge dollar figure compared to 30 years ago. Yes, because things cost more and there's more people settled in the area. And there's also been a lot of people building in areas where they shouldn't. And that's a fact. That's a fact of life, unfortunately. So if you have a typhoon that's exactly the same as it was 30 years ago, you probably will create more damage in a dollar term. But in reality, it's probably doing nothing different than what it did the last time it landed in that area. So climate change, hopefully, we will see what happens with the Libs. The Nationals have dropped out of it. They definitely don't want it here in Australia. It remains to be seen. They're talking about it at the moment. But there could very well be a leadership spill within the Liberal Party if that's the direction they wish to continue to go, because I know there's quite a few senators within the Liberal Party that are not happy, and a lot of few people out in the sticks, as it were, that are also seeing the impact that it's having upon farmers and local regional communities. So at some stage, the pushback from the people has to be great enough. And as I said at the beginning of every one of these podcasts, it's up to the grassroots to solve the problem. And I believe it is. It's up to the people of Australia and the rest of the world, where they can, to open their eyes to the realities of the world and ask that those realities be addressed, not some fanciful notion that some climate model has predicted. We have we have a big battery in New South Wales that's having some issues at the moment. It's supposed to be the shock absorber for the intermittent renewables. At full tilt, it lasts about 2 hours if it's been fully charged prior to that. So if we're in the event of a blackout, we certainly can't run on it all the time. It's a $500 million investment by BlackRock. Also, I think there's quite an investment in by NGS Super, so they're using our super money as well. And $100 million from the Australian government. Now, I don't know whether that's a direct grant, whether it's a subsidy, or what it is. But this amount of money into a battery situation, which is basically a shock absorber, has had a huge catastrophic failure of two of its transformers, I believe, just recently. They set it up to get it going, and they didn't put the third one online. They have three transformers because they were worried that the third one may also blow out as well. So they've got to go back to the drawing board to be rewired or whatever it is they've got to be done. I believe they come out of Victoria, which is a good thing. They're being made here in Australia, so they can be fixed here in Australia. that time frame. I'm not too sure what it is, and I would suggest it will be quite a time frame. There's something like that. It's a huge number of tons. I didn't look at that. It was in the 400 tons or something area. They're quite considerable. They take a bit to bring up here, take a bit to wind. So they've got to be fixed. If it's something that comes in from overseas, we've discussed this before in past conversations, transformers and the like for the whole grid are things that usually come from overseas, a lot of them to be replaced. There's a fair waiting time at the moment. In the US, I know there's a 21-month wait for these sorts of transformers, up to, which is 2 years, or up to 3 years and 4 years at times for some of these big transformers if they actually fail. So what are we setting ourselves up for in doing this? Again, this is something I think that hasn't been thought out properly when it comes to net zero, and the big push by Minister Bowen to do all these things. We've got all these great ideas and all these great possibilities ahead of us, but when it comes down to the nitty-gritty of it, the real crux of the problem is that we have not prepared. We are not organized enough. It's been done far too rapidly, rolled out without a lot of thought, to the way I see it. And so that's going to be put back by probably another 12 months, so it won't be online. It's just interesting. It's linked to all sorts of other little bits and pieces that are still going on within net zero, and we're not seeing the realization of the promises being made. So that's one of those things that's happening. Let's see what else we got. The BBC. The BBC is in the news recently, and I did notice that this morning's hard headline articles, Donald Trump's going to sue them for $1 billion. Why is this coming about? Well, apparently the Director General and the news CEO are resigning. If you remember back in January 6th, 21, when there was the insurrection at the White House, where people supposedly overran the White House and caused all sorts of issues, and unfortunately, one lady was shot dead. Whether they were let in, whether the crowd was whipped up into a frenzy, whether these things were the direct result of Donald Trump's speech, was argued over incessantly for quite some time, and he was accused of all sorts of things. It now comes to light that the BBC article that was shown linked two parts of his speech. The first part where he was saying to the talking to the crowd, and the last part 54 minutes later where he said, "We're going to fight and we're going to fight like hell," were linked together one after the other, and it made it sound as though he was inciting. And that went on several times. I believe it was aired around the world in lots of different ways. But it's now come to light, of course, that was stitched together. Now, whether it was done intentionally or whether it was done just because that's what we do with sound bites these days, is up for question, I guess. But the reality of these sorts of things that go on, and they do go on, people often find that you go to an event and you listen to the speeches and you go home and you don't think anything of it. But later on, when you see that on the news, they've picked out little sound bites here and there and put them up, and you get a different picture to what you see. Well, the BBC has been accused of this. Not only accused of it, they've been proven that that's what they've done here. And heads have rolled. So they've lost their director general, who's in the position for 5 years. So he would have been there in 21. Since his 20-year career in it, and also the chief news editor. So you ask yourself, there was a lot of carry-on, there was a lot of congressional hearings all about, you know, whether he incited the riot. And with that sort of stuff floating around in the public's mind, in the public view, what sort of an impact does that actually have? There's a lot of people out there who will see that and they'll say, well, yes, he did. He incited it. That's obvious. That causes a flow-on effect into the whole of society. So this misrepresentation that goes on can have drastic consequences. It can remove support from a legitimate leader. If he got in legitimately, then that sort of information 4 years on can still be having impacts. There'd be people out there who still believe that that's what happened. And that doesn't do much for the cohesion in society, does it, when you think about it? Now, truth in reporting is supposed to be something that is very important worldwide, but we're not seeing as much as we should be. There's a lot of sound bites, a lot of sensationalism. And when it comes down to it, you've got to be very careful now what you actually believe when you see things. It's a sad, sad day for reporting that these sorts of things are allowed to go on and go on for 4 years. It's only now that it's come to light. It's only now that it's been brought out into the open. I believe it occurred some time prior due to a leak by... let's see if I can find it. Anyway, someone who was an independent auditor within the BBC had complained about the issues that were being raised. There were issues that were not so good. Yeah, that's it there. There he is. I can't read that one. Where are we? So he brought it to light that there were problems and that the BBC was not addressing issues when they arose. And he was just frustrated. And eventually it was leaked out to the Telegraph. It shouldn't have to happen like that. It shouldn't be a whistleblower. If something has been done and it's done wrong, they should be happy to admit it. And well, not happy to admit it, but they should at least be honest enough to admit it and to publish a retraction. However, this hasn't happened at this point, which is why we're seeing a big carry-on with it. And so we should. When this sort of thing comes to light, it really needs to be addressed properly. The buck may stop at, the management, but when a problem happens, yeah, heads have to roll. But we've already had 4 years of distrust and division within the United States economy or the United States community because of it. So, we really need to be careful when we look at all news items. Are we getting the truth? What does it look like? How do we know is the biggest question. And I think learning to think critically, starting to educate yourself in as many possible ways as you can is one way, but also looking at a large number of sources of information. I always look at quite a few different sources to look at and see what they're saying. And then you've got to put on your hat and think, well, does that sound right? And looking at history and looking at what other people are saying is the only way you can really get around to seeing what's really going on. And sometimes it takes a while to understand that you've been lied to or that the information you're being fed is not entirely accurate. That's another way of putting it, I suppose. There's another issue in Germany at the moment, which I thought came up, was quite interesting because, again, this goes back in history. If you look at the rise of the Nazi Party in the 30s, there was a lot of opposition members to the Nazis who were taken out of the equation in one way or the other. And we see today, although we don't have the right-wing government in Germany, they've got a very big, a big fear of anything right-wing or anything nationalist. So that's been drummed out of them for a long time. But just recently, before a series of elections in the north of Germany, they had six candidates from Germany's right-wing AfD party. It's alternative for Deutschland is what the AfD is. It came out of the Christian socialist movement. But they had six candidates die within 13 days apart in the lead up to their local elections. And if you read that article, it's interesting, very interesting. There's been a number of people talking about it. Dr. John Campbell also put together a bit to see about statistical anomalies within that. And it is highly, highly unlikely that that would have happened because of normal circumstances. However, the government is, they've denied that there's anything going on, but they are looking into it. That is the way it's been left at this point in time. But it's not just these six either, because there are a number of other AfD members who have also disappeared. Naomi Seat, who's pictured here on the left, the blonde lass there, she's very young. She's only 25. She's been touted as the anti-Greta Thunberg because she doesn't believe in climate change, and she's been fairly vocal about it. She said she was going to vote for the AfD in the coming elections, and she's had a large number of death threats, and she's now looking for asylum in America. She put some tweets on X, and I believe that Elon Musk got in contact with her, or she got in contact with Elon to try and find if she could get some sort of protection because she's had these threats against her. And with the rise of the deaths before the election, she's saying that there's a lot more going on behind the scenes that we're actually seeing. So those are worth looking at, these articles, which are in the chat box beside here. What's happening? What is happening in Germany? I mean, the alternative for Deutschland is so-called extreme right-wing, which is one of the labels that gets put upon anybody who is opposing the current narrative. You don't have to be extreme right-wing. You don't have to be pushing anything that is anything like what you would expect from extreme right-wing. But because of the label, it becomes an issue. Now, they're looking with Germany's got the same problems as we've got in many ways, and the same clones the UK has got, in some cases worse. They have a huge migrant problem that's just excessive immigration. They've got all the things that go with that societal division, and there are people asking for Germany back. They want the Germany that they know. They want their fellow citizens to be looked after first. So it's not an unreasonable stance to take when it's your own country to wish that your own people in your own country are looked after. And we're seeing that the current regime that's in there is not happy with the opposition. And yeah, because of Germany's worry about the rise of another right-wing party, it's been drummed into them for years not to, not to believe in that sort of thing, or not to talk about it, and to be scared if someone does start talking about it to dob in your neighbour. And it's just an unfortunate situation, because once you start labelling people incorrectly, then they then become a target as well. So this young lass who's been talking out and speaking out about climate and the things that she's concerned about, which she should have every right to do, especially if she's deciding to stand as a politician or stand for parliament, which I'm not too sure that she is. But why, why should there be death threats? Why should she have to flee? She's got one particular opinion. And if it's an unpopular opinion, she won't get elected. If it's something that is the people are saying, well, I can agree with that, then that's fine. Why shouldn't she be elected? We're talking about democracy here. We're talking about people being allowed freedom of speech. And yet here she is, she's looking for asylum. So, yeah, and I started off by saying about the deaths. I'm just very concerned that this sort of thing is starting to show its head. How accurate is it? You know, what sort of thing is it leading to? We've seen it before in the past. We saw it in the communist countries. The opposition just disappeared. And now we're seeing it now in what's supposed to be a democratic and free society. Is it actually happening? That's the question, isn't it? That's the question. But all the signs are there that it needs to be looked at. I would like to see a bit more of it being looked at. Statistical analyses are done for reasons to try and work out whether something's simply a possibility or whether it's just an accident or a coincidence. But that's why we do statistical analysis, to see if there's some sort of a trend. And at the moment, it's looking like there's a trend. All right, on to the next article. What else have we got here? We've had the BBC. Yes, the Canadian situation. I read an article this afternoon, or this morning, sorry, because it's only morning here. They were talking about offering, I thought I had it open here. Yeah, the Canadian military are going to rely on an army of public servants to boost its ranks by 300,000. They're offering positions within the army. They're going to have limited limited requirements. You don't have to meet any special requirements as such. They're going to drop their requirements a bit to allow people to come in. You've got to ask yourself, what's going on here? Why would the Canadian military suddenly want to swell their ranks by public servants and boost them by 300,000? There's only about 47,000 in the military at the moment. Interesting. Again, where they get these ideas, I don't know. Are they thinking they're going to war? And who are they going to war with if they are thinking they're going to war? Are they going to look at increased surveillance? Maybe that's the reason for, because they've been talking about, they're going to be taught to do things like handle rifles and fly drones and drive trucks. I think that's what was mentioned up there in the blue. Another article that's worth looking at. Where does this stand in the scheme of things? Why are we looking at having that sort of thing brought about? The only thing I can think of is if, they're looking for drones for a surveillance state. But that's I would have thought, fairly far-fetched. But these days, far-fetched things are seeming to be coming to the fore all the time. And you have to start asking questions. Why? What is the intention behind that? What, it's, do they need them? Are they looking at some particular reason? There's got to be a reason for it. And maybe if they're trying to spend some money into the economy, they want to give the public servants a bit more money to spend to try and boost the economy. That's another reason, I suppose, which would be an interesting concept. I could think of better ways of doing it. So that's a watch this space episode. How are we going for time? It's 12 past. Net zero. COP 30 in Brazil. We're coming to the end of the podcast, I think, folks. It's going to be a bit shorter than usual. I don't have anyone else to bounce my ideas off today. So I would just like to remind you all that many of the issues that we face today are as a direct result of stress, financial stress. And the reason that Douglas Social Credit exists is because Douglas recognized a problem within the financial world. And that problem was the creation and distribution of money. There's what he called the A plus B theorem, whereby all the money coming to existence to be able to be spent comes in as wages and dividends. And yet there are more costs to produce stuff than the money being given out that can actually buy it. I don't know if I'm making it really clear, but effectively, the method of putting purchasing power into the hands of the community to buy the materials being produced is faulty. That never equals the amount of material being produced, so that not all of the material being produced can be consumed, at which time we have a surplus. And if we have a surplus and we still have money owing, then we look for ways to get rid of that surplus. And export is usually the best way of doing that. We can sell it to someone else and get their money. And if they're doing exactly the same thing, they're trying also to sell their surplus and get a favorable balance of trade, which is a strange term in its own, a favorable balance of trade, whereby we get rid of more than we bring in. How that is giving away materials is a favorable balance of trade, I will never really figure out, other than the fact that we're bringing in money from somewhere else to try and prop up the economy. So when you think about that, and then you also add to that the rise of the machine, the rise of the ability to do work without human input. And again, that increases further the distance between the spending power the consumer has and the actual production that's being made. So we can make so much more, and yet the money's not going into the hands of the consumer to buy it. So this one thing alone is going to create problems within the financial system. Add to that the fact that all money is created as debt and has to be repaid at interest, where the interest component is never created in the first place, is another problem. And I think in the real world, we're seeing the issues that we've got. And as I said at the beginning of the broadcast, wars are fought primarily over financial issues. When you go back through history, you'll see that it goes from trade wars from the ability to survive within a community to becoming, the financial system. I'm quoting here from a social credit article by Dr. Oliver Haydorn. The financial system is beyond all doubt the main cause of internal friction, since, as we have seen, no nation can buy its own production, which is what I was just talking about. It is inevitable there will be a struggle for markets in which to get rid of the surplus. The translation of this commercial struggle in a military context is simply a matter of time and opportunity. Social creditors have repeatedly warned that there is a chronic economic cause and entirely artificial in nature, and therefore unnecessary, which inexorably leads nations to take up arms against one another. Due to the underlying deficit in consumer purchasing power that afflicts all industrial societies, operating under standard banking and accounting conventions, countries are frequently pressured to alleviate the lack of liquidity in the domestic economy by seeking to export more than they import. The so-called favorable balance of trade, which is undoubtedly unfavorable in real terms because it implies a net loss of real wealth, which is why I said earlier that I couldn't believe that you would look at a favorable balance of trade and say that it's favorable. It helps the economy cover that gap when you can actually export more. It helps to cover the gap between prices of the consumer and the consumer's income by getting rid of part of that surplus production. And when you look at it, this is not from Oliver, this is my... When you look at that, you can export as much as you like in the way of bombs and vehicles and things to destroy. It's a never-ending export. So that's got to prop up the economy because people are being paid to make these things that you can never consume because they're being destroyed. The consumption of them doesn't have to be paid for. We automatically pay for them by creating them. So it's a problem that is mathematically impossible for all nations in the world to export more than they import. It's a zero-sum game. For every exporting champion, there must be a loser with a trade deficit. Countries that import more than they export are faced with a problem of a gap that has become even worse as a result of their commercial activities. Since every country is operating under the same internal deficit of purchasing power, the struggle for a favorable balance of trade constitutes a struggle for survival. And this leads quite naturally to economic conflict, or rather to economic warfare, in the form of commercial wars and free trade alliances. And all too often, it can force or at least introduce a military conflict. A country that does not manage to compete successfully through innovation, hard work, or achieving lower prices than its rivals in the global struggle for an artificial scarce flow of purchasing power can choose to ensure its victory through war by defeating his economic opponents on the battlefield. The real reason for war will, of course, be more or less hidden from the public, and a pretext will be found. But the war may allow the aggressor to destroy part of his rival's productive capacity and or, through the eventual signature of peace treaties, to insist on more favorable commercial conditions for himself as part of reparations. And again, we've seen that within the end of the war, and we reflect on the wars during Remembrance Day, as I said earlier. We really need to think a little bit deeper than just the loss of life and the so-called political machinations that they blame it on. To finish this little article, another paragraph, the pressure placed on nations to compensate for their internal gaps between prices and incomes with favorable trade balances is intensified by the universally defended policy of full employment. If we insist madly, in direct opposition to the real physical potential of the modern industrial economy, that all must work, or almost all must work, in the formal economy in order to obtain that purchasing power, or got to be supported by those who do, then we are demanding continued economic growth as an end to itself, as a means of distributing additional income as the population grows. The resulting production must find some outlet. If it can't be absorbed internally, a market must be secured for it abroad. It was for that reason that John Hargrave, leader of the Green Shirts, a paramilitary social credit group of the 1930s, courageously proclaimed on more than one occasion that he who cries for full employment cries for war. Major Douglas explored this in detail, in some detail, the purely economic causes behind modern war, in a BBC speech entitled The Causes of War. And those are both available here to watch on YouTube. Links are in the side there. And you would do well to listen to some of these thoughts and comments by Douglas, because they are important and they have the potential to create a better society in which to live. We face so many different things these days that we don't wish to see. We face so many different restrictions from our governments as they argue incessantly, opposition against the incumbent, about what to do about this and what to do about that and how we're going to solve this problem. But if they're arguing from a flawed basis to start with, then their arguments will be in vain. And as a public, we need to educate ourselves so that we can put these correct views into the hands of our local politicians, or set someone up to actually take this message to Parliament and try and enact some of the truths, the real truths of the world, of which proper financial functioning is one. I will leave the podcast on this, and I thank you all for watching today. And hope to be with you again next week. So, thank you. Good afternoon.
This country's not going to be saved from the top because that's where all the rot is. It's too deep. It's going to be saved from the grassroots.